Hey, it's Scott, and guess what? You're about to hear an ad. And that's both good and bad. It's good because ads are what make it possible for me to keep bringing you these episodes. And it's bad because, well, maybe you don't like listening to ads, and I get that. And the good news is, you don't have to. When you sign up to support the show, you get every single episode without any ads. Plus, you get all the bonus episodes. Yeah, did you know there are actually bonus episodes? And you can try it all for free just to see what it's like. If you're on an iPhone, just go to the What Was That Like podcast and at the top, click on Try Free and you're in. On Android, just go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus and try it out completely free. Once you've had the ad-free experience, you'll see why hundreds of other listeners are already doing it. But for now, here's another ad and then on with today's episode. I'll confess, sometimes I let my podcast playlist get out of hand and I get way behind, but there's one show that I subscribe to and any new episode goes right to the top of the queue. That's the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's because I never have to figure out, okay, is this one going to be interesting or do I wait for the next one like I do for some shows? Because Jordan's conversations are always a must listen for me. He talks to fascinating people from any category you can think of. Authors, scientists, athletes, you name it. He's talked to undercover cops who posed as mafia and the actual career mafia hitmen. And the stories he gets out of these people, just incredible. In one episode, he talked to Paul Holes. You might know that name if you're into true crime. He's the former investigator who uses really advanced methods to solve cold cases, including the Golden State Killer. And another one I really enjoyed was with Sam Harris, an author and neuroscientist who promotes skepticism, and he doesn't mind taking on some seriously controversial topics like politics or religion. That one's going to make you think. Whenever a new episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show pops up, I already know it's going to be an episode that I'll enjoy listening to, and I'll bet you will too. For some episode recommendations, check out jordanharbinger.com/start. Or search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
What Was That Like? Contains adult language and content and is not intended for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to What Was That Like? I'm your host, Scott Johnson. This is the show where we talk to regular people, people just like you or just like me, who have found themselves in an extremely unusual situation. We'll hear their stories and get inside their head because we all want to know, what was that like? More information about each episode at whatwasthatlike.com. Here we go. I've been friends with Sue for several years, so I know what she's like. And after you hear this conversation I had with Sue recently, you'll have a pretty good idea too. I hope you're ready. October 24, 2015. Sue was with her daughter Jessica, who was just 14 years old at the time, and her friend Elise. Elise and Sue were skydiving buddies, and they were doing what they often did on a beautiful Saturday morning. They were going to go jump out of a plane. Now, since she was 14, Jessica wasn't yet old enough to jump, but she just liked being with her mom and hanging out at the drop zone. The weather was beautiful, and everything was going fine until Sue got to about 5,000 feet. She tried to make a quick turn just before landing, and things went terribly wrong. The thing about Sue is she has a heart full of compassion and love like few people I know. And even though she was on the ground, unable to move, with broken bones and in just excruciating pain, her primary concern was for her daughter. She didn't want Jessica to see her in pain and be traumatized by that. Now, obviously, Sue survived. And wait till you hear what she's done since then. In the show notes for this episode, I'll have a link to the blog post that Sue wrote about her ordeal, and there's also a video of the first part of that fateful jump, the freefall part. You can see that at whatwasthatlike.com/17. And did you know that I post something interesting or thought-provoking every single day on Instagram? You can follow me at What Was That Like? And now, please enjoy my conversation with Sue. Sue, my friend, thanks for coming on the show.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
You know, I want to give people a little bit of background that so they know we have known each other for years, literally, in a variety of different contexts, too. Well, actually, a couple of different contexts. You and I are part of the ultra marathon community. We've both done long ultra marathons. Matter of fact, I think I actually interviewed you on a different podcast when you finished your first 100 miler. Was that right?
You did.
Yeah, that's been a few years ago. And I know we see each other at races fairly regularly. And we've also worked with the homeless. You have a heart for the homeless community like I do. And we've gone to places and given out food and blankets and stuff like that. And I know we both enjoy doing stuff like that as well.
We do. Thanks, Scott.
And not only that, but you are a listener to this podcast, like from the first episode, I think, right?
Yes, I love your podcasts and I love podcasts in general.
And now you have fulfilled your lifetime dream of coming on this show, right?
It was one of my bucket lists.
I am happy to help make that happen. And I have to tell you this. I don't think I've ever told you this before, but you are one of the three most positive-minded people that I know. One of them is my friend Andrea, who I used to work with, and I still see her every once in a while. The second one is my mom, and the third one is you. It's like everything you see or do, you kind of, no matter what it's like, you spin it into something positive, and you just seem like you just love life. Is that pretty much your outlook?
That is. Thank you, Scott. That's nice. Sure.
Okay, well, let's talk about the events leading up to this this day, this thing that happened. Skydiving. How many solo jumps had you done before that day?
So I had 77 jumps before that day, solo jumps. And then I probably had 8 tandem jumps prior to that.
77, to the average person, that seems like, wow, that's a lot of jumps. But in the skydiving world, that's not really, that's kind of still a newbie, right?
Oh, yes. That's baby steps. I had dreams of having thousands of jumps, but didn't get there yet.
I know you really love skydiving, but when you went up that first time, I mean, I've seen videos of people going their first tandem jump or even their first solo jump. How scared were you the first time you jumped out of a plane?
I was pretty scared. And I think that every skydiver that I know still, no matter how many jumps they have, there's still that healthy respect for getting up in the plane and doing what you're going to do. But my very first tandem, I was scared. I kept asking my tandem instructor, are you sure that we're connected? Are you sure we're connected? But as soon the second we fell out of the airplane, I was in heaven. It was the most exhilarating, beautiful, peaceful, chaotic, serene thing I've ever done. And I instantly fell in love. And in fact, the very first time I did that was at an ultra event, the Skydive Ultra. My first tandem was in January 2015, where you did a tandem jump and then you ran a 50K. So I did, I think, 3 tandem jumps, then ran a 50K, and then did 2 tandem jumps afterwards because I just loved it. It was phenomenal.
So you did 5 jumps that day?
Yes.
Had you planned to do that, or you just realized after the first one that you loved it so much?
Absolutely not. I just realized it after the first one, how much I loved it. And that feeling of freedom and speed and chaos and beauty is just something I just can't describe it. It's hard to describe.
I know I've heard you say before, and I've heard other people say that the people that have not done it, you just don't understand until you do it.
Right.
And I have not done it, so I don't understand it. But what I find curious though, is your use of the word chaos right in the middle of
beauty and speed and silence? And how does chaos fit into that?
So it's interesting because there's so many things happening at the same time. You're falling through the sky, which is an unnatural feeling, but you see the curvature of the earth, the beauty, there's a bunch of noise. So it's chaotic and beautiful all at once. And it's once the tandem instructor, once we came under canopy, it was just all of that noise stops and it's just quiet and it's beautiful. And gosh, I miss it.
All right. Well, before we get into that day, I've got one more question to ask you before we talk about that one jump. What, in general, what is your pain tolerance like?
I have a pretty high tolerance for pain, and I think many people will tell you that as well. I think anyone who runs ultramarathons has to have at least some high level of pain tolerance, but it's pretty high.
All right. So let's talk about that day. The fateful day when this happened. So you were with your friend Elise, and also with you was your daughter Jessica.
Yes. So my daughter Jessica was 14 at the time. So she absolutely loved coming with me to the drop zone, and she would love watching the whole process and really liked the vibe. So she came along that day, and my friend Elise is who I did my very first tandem jump with. Elise and I became licensed skydivers together, took the class together, and did many of our jumps together. So we went to the drop zone. It was only our second time at this particular drop zone, so we didn't have that many jumps there. I think we had three or four from the prior weeks.
And this was a drop zone that you didn't normally go to. What made you decide to go there that day?
You know, I can't specifically remember. I think the drop zone, our home drop zone, which was in Zephyr Hill or is in Zephyr Hills, Florida, there was something wrong with the plane or something that day. I don't recall, but we decided we wanted to jump. Let's go to the other drop zone that's like a half hour, 45 minutes away.
And that's in Plant City, Florida.
Right, in Plant City.
And were there any weather problems that day?
No, it was a beautiful, gosh, it was an October morning, absolutely beautiful fall morning in Florida, a little humid, the sun was just coming up, dew was, you know, on the grass, and anytime you go to a drop zone, there's just this level of excitement, electricity in the air, which I absolutely love. So it was just a beautiful, gorgeous morning. I just got a brand new custom Tony suit, a skydiving suit. So I was pretty excited to wear that. And we were ready to have a great day of jumps. We planned to get five or six jumps in. It's definitely a smaller drop zone than Z Hills, but great place to jump. And
for the average person, someone that has not skydived before, we don't really know what the process is as far as getting your suit on and gear checks and double checks and all that. Can you take us through that as it happened that day and then as how everything played out?
Yeah. So the morning, the jump started out like any other jump. As soon as we got to the drop zone, we turned on our automatic activation devices, our AADs, my altimeter, checked my rig from top to bottom, did one more double check before putting on my Tony suit. And then Elise and I both checked each other's gear. And we always have someone else, because we're new jumpers, someone else at the drop zone would check our gear as well and do a pin check for us. So we get on the plane, and there are a total of 9 people on the plane. There are 3 tandems, Elise and I, and another jumper by the name of Lee, who asked if he could videotape our jump, and you know, he was practicing his video skills, and we said, absolutely, come on, let's do this. So we get on the plane, and there's this level of excitement on a skydiving plane that you just can't describe. It's actually palpable, in my opinion, the level of excitement. But there's also a certain fear and respect that, you know, what we're about to do is something very serious. As jovial as everyone is and as excited as everyone is, safety is everyone's 100%, it's priority 100% of the time is safety. So, you know, we get on the plane and a new jumper, I'm always double checking my gear, double checking my pin. And we're talking to the guys on the way up who are tandems. And I think it was a bachelor weekend for them. One of the guys was getting married and it's a pretty small plane. And he said, "Hey, do you mind if we do a couple barrel rolls?" And Elise and I look at each other and our eyes widen real big. And we're like, "Heck no, that's great. I've never been in a plane that's done a barrel roll before." So it's a pretty small plane. And so they talk to the pilot and the pilot says, "Sure, we can do that." So we stand up and we're like it's like a starfish figure in the plane because it's a pretty small plane. And Elise and I are standing up with our, you know, our hands on the roof of the plane and our feet spread apart. And we did three barrel rolls in the plane, which is really kind of neat. It was kind of exciting. I got a little dizzy for a second, but it was good. We leveled off and then got to altitude and, you know, the green light goes on, the door goes open in the plane and you get ready to jump. And, you know, before we got on the plane, you know, there's a landing pattern that you have to do in order to land after you jump. And there's a plan that you have to have that you need to have in place. So Elise and I talked about the landing pattern. We checked the winds and we asked someone else at the drop zone to double check our landing pattern because we're new jumpers and we want to make sure that our plan is actually would be safe and is the right thing to do.
And the idea with a landing pattern is that you want to actually touch down or come in against the wind. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. So, and when we're getting to altitude, we also, Elise and I always made the habit of talking about our landing pattern again, just to make sure that, that we're both on the same page and we both know what we're doing. And so, the plane, the door goes open and I love the sound of the swishing of the door opening because then the wind gets in the plane and we get our helmets on, push the eyesight down and Lee is jumping. He's out on the plane. He's videotaping. So he's already left the plane, but he's hanging out on the side, waiting for Elise and I jump. And it's funny because you don't really jump out of a plane. You kind of just fall out of it. And it's the most wonderful feeling in the world. It's just fabulous. I don't know how to describe it, but it's exhilarating. It's beautiful.
Here's my hot take for today. If you see something advertised as a free trial, it might cost you more than you expect. At least that's my experience. I give up my credit card to try something for free for a week, then I forget about it, and now I'm paying for it every month without even noticing it. But when I signed up for Rocket Money, that ridiculous waste came to a screeching halt. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending, and it helps you lower your bills so you can grow your savings. It lets you see all of your subscriptions listed right there in one place. When you see a subscription you're paying for but you don't want, do you really want to spend an hour on the phone trying to track down some customer service agent to cancel it? Rocket Money can help you get rid of it with just a few taps. They also give me this great dashboard so I can see what I've spent this month compared to last month. And they'll even try to negotiate lower bills for me by up to 20%. So I'm spending less and saving more. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features.
Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/whatwas. That's rocketmoney.com/whatwas. rocketmoney.com/whatwas.
I made a decision a long time ago. When I'm out riding my bike each morning and I cross paths with someone, I always smile at that person. And most people smile back. But I do it because even though it's a little thing, it makes a big difference for me and maybe for them. It's just a fact. Small actions can bring big benefits. In the same way, it's also true that taking care of your gut can support the health of the rest of your body. Seed's DSO1 Daily Symbiotic benefits not just your gut, but your skin and heart health too. Seed DSO1 is part of my morning routine. If you can call it a routine, it's just two little capsules. And I feel amazing. It helps maintain the health of my heart, and it promotes regularity, which I can attest to. Sorry, that may be a little TMI there. For me, it's great that it's vegan, but it's also sugar-free, soy-free, peanut-free, gluten-free, and has no preservatives. It doesn't even need refrigeration. DSO1 has so many benefits, including the fact that it's backed by a lot of science, but I've barely scratched the surface here. What I can say, though, is that my body feels great, and I've got a promo code so you can see the benefits for yourself.
Trust your gut with Seed's DSO1 Daily Symbiotic. Go to seed.com/what and use code 25what to get 25% off your first month. That's 25% off your first month of Seed's DSO1 Daily Symbiotic at seed.com/what. Code 25what.
Hey, this is Scott. Did you know we offer a premium feed of this show that is completely ad-free and there are bonus episodes? Go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus or just click the link in the show notes of any episode to learn more and to sign up. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, you can sign up right there in the app by clicking Try Free at the top of the episode list. And I hope to see you in the premium feed soon.
So Elise and I jump, and it's a gorgeous morning. The sun had come up. It wasn't too hot yet. And at this particular drop zone, there are pine trees that are very, very tall. And the drop zone that I'm used to jumping at doesn't have pine trees, but I know that any obstacle, like a pine tree or a building or anything, there's going to be turbulence associated with it. So I'm just worried initially about the pine trees, but it hasn't overcome any of my thoughts at all. But I see, so we jump and we're having a great time. And I feel like the wind has shifted a little bit. It just felt different. And I see Elise, she's farther away from me than what she usually is. And I'm thinking to myself, well, that's kind of weird. Why is she way over there? I'm over here and I'm not under canopy yet. And I'm just under canopy at about 5,000 feet, which is usually, I won't pull any lower than that. And I see that she's far away. So I'm like, oh goodness. And I'm looking down and looking around at the ground to see where I'm supposed to land. And the trees, I'm worried about hitting the trees. And I remember something in class that we took. If you look at something and you focus on something, you're going to end up going that way. So I'm like, I'm not going to look at the trees, but I'm still worried about it. I'm worried that if I come down too close to the trees, I'll hit the tree. But it's funny. That's what I was worried about. So I decided not come down lower. So I changed my landing pattern, which was definitely the wrong thing to do. And I thought I would come up a little higher above the trees so I wouldn't hit them. So when I came up higher above the trees, obviously my landing pattern is going to elongate than what it would have initially. So it's still a beautiful skydive. I'm not overly concerned. I'm not overly worried. I'm under canopy. It's quiet. And as soon as I come over the trees and I realize, and this all happens pretty quickly, and I realize, oh my goodness, I really don't have that much of a runway left. And I'm still coming down pretty fast. And I know that I still have to hang a turn to land properly. But as I'm coming in pretty fast, there's a barn in front of me. And I'm thinking, shoot, if I still come down as fast as I'm coming, I'm going to hit that barn. And if I hit that barn, I'm probably not going to live.
So that's a bad thing.
It's a bad thing. And all of this happens in like a split second. I said, okay, obviously I want to live and I'm going to turn left. So as I turned left, when you're turning left, you're moving your left arm. So the canopy, the cells turn, you know, the whole canopy turns and your cells turn left. So as I did that, I look up for a split second to check it to see if what my canopy was doing. And the last three or four cells of my canopy collapse. And I knew something bad was going to happen. And what happens now is really slow. Like it happened really fast, but in my mind, I can remember every single detail. And it's really bizarre. The absolute first thought and pervading thought of everything else that happened was of my daughter, and like her face just was there, just in my head. And all I could think of was Jessica, she's here. And I just couldn't stop thinking about her. So as I'm falling to the ground, her face, and I can see her playing on the beach as a baby. It was just really bizarre. As I'm falling.
Wow. So this is like one of those things where you're maybe about to die and your life flashes before your eyes. But in your case, it was your daughter flashing before your eyes.
Yes, it wasn't. It's the only thing, the absolute only thought that I had was of her and like pictures. It was weird. It was just bizarre. So as I'm falling to and this is happening fast, as I'm falling to the ground, I can see all of a sudden I have this hyper focus, this myopic view of what I'm going to hit. I could see the individual blades of grass. I could see the dirt, the little specks of dirt on the grass that I was going to hit. And that all happens in a second. So I hit the ground and I think I blacked out for a second. And I remember hitting the ground and I remember hearing a thud, like feeling my body hit the ground. And then I blacked out for a few seconds. And when I opened my eyes, I was like, oh my goodness, I am alive. Thank the Lord I'm alive. And I couldn't have been happier. I absolutely could not have been happier. And it didn't matter at that point in time if whatever was broken, whatever hurt, whatever needed to be fixed, it didn't matter what it was because I was alive and I would be able to see my daughter again. So I hit the ground and I think Lee had already landed. And I don't know, someone called 911 and Elise was landing. And all I could think of is my daughter is here. She's 14. I'm not sure yet that she knows that that was me who had a bad landing. And I don't want her to see me or hear me. I don't want her to hear me in pain because when I hit and once I got my wits about me, all I could do was moan. There was no screaming out in pain. It was just moaning because that's all I could do. I couldn't move my left side. I could wiggle my toes, which I was very happy. I thought, okay, if I can wiggle my toes, that means I'm probably not paralyzed. But I couldn't move the left side of my body without being in excruciating pain. And I had my full-faced skydiving helmet still on. And Lee came running over and I said, please, all of a sudden I got a little panic, like take this helmet off because I couldn't see and there was dirt all in it. So he took that off and
were you face down or face up?
I was face down. So I landed when you take skydiving lessons, they teach you how to land a parachute landing fall. I think it's a PLF and you land. If you ever have to land and you're not on your feet, you land on your side. So I landed on my side, thankfully. And after Lee took my helmet off, I don't know how many seconds it was, but my daughter, I described to Lee, I said, Lee, my daughter's 14. She has long blonde hair. She's wearing jeans or shorts and a t-shirt or whatever. If you see a young lady come over who looks like that, tell me and I will stop moaning because I don't want her to hear me in pain. I want her to know that I'm okay. So he'd say, okay, she's like 50 feet, 20 feet. And she'd come over and I said, honey, mom's fine. Can you go to the car and get my driver's license? So she would go to the car and as soon as she was out of earshot, I would moan again because the pain was just excruciating. And she would come back and I'd say, thanks, honey. Now can you go get my sunglasses? And she would go to the car and she would do that. And then the third time I asked her to go get my insurance card because I knew that the paramedics were coming and I reassured her that I was okay, but I knew she was worried. And I knew my friend Elise was worried and Elise was there. And I asked Elise, call Bill, tell him I've had an accident, but I'm alive. And Bill's my husband. And just tell him I'll be okay. And Jessica has the number, so you guys can just call Bill. So they did all that. And I asked Lee, I had my brand new rig on. And I said, Lee, I don't want them cutting off my rig. Let's see how, you know, if you could get the chest straps and leg straps off, if we can just lift the rig off so they don't cut it. So Lee helped. I couldn't move. So he undid the chest strap and undid the straps around my legs and lifted the rig. So the paramedics didn't cut that. So it seemed like it took them forever to get there. It probably didn't, but I was in a lot of pain.
Where was the pain you were feeling at that time?
So it was my back, my leg, like my whole pelvis area, that whole from my abdomen down was hurting. But the most pain was really in my back and my pelvis. And so it seemed like it took the paramedics a long time to get there. It didn't. I'm sure it didn't. And it was the Hillsborough County paramedics who were just absolutely wonderful. So they came and I can hear them trying to figure out how are they going to roll me over to get me on the board. And I know that when they do that, it's going to be excruciatingly painful. And I try to negotiate with them and say, wait, can't you just like leave me on my stomach and and do it that way? And they're like, no, we really need to turn you over. So,
and you knew that even though you were telling me.
I knew it. And, you know, when they do that quick body assessment to see what's broken or whatever, I was like, please don't squish my pelvis or my abs. Like, don't do that because that's going to hurt. And he's like, look, I got to. So that was extremely painful. And I think probably the only time I screamed out in pain where my daughter was present was during that time where they did that initial assessment. So they kind of flipped me over and I don't remember exactly how, but I remember it being very painful how they flipped me. I just don't, it's like, it's gone. I don't know how they did it, but they flipped me over and I couldn't put my left leg down in a straight position because it was too painful. So I asked them to, you know, leave my leg up and found a pillow and put a pillow, and they kept telling me it's going to be bumpy when we get you on the stretcher and try to get you into the ambulance. And I was like, just give me something for the pain. Like, just, I'll take the bumps, you know, just give me something to take the edge off a little bit. So
I'm kind of surprised that, you know, when some people, when they get into be so much pain, they just pass out from the pain, but you weren't that fortunate, I guess.
No. And I don't know. I want to be aware of everything and I want to be in control of, at least try to be in control of whatever I could at that point in time, because I'm just helpless. Like I can't move. I can't walk. I can't do anything, but I want to try to be in control. And I asked them where they were taking me, And they said the closest trauma center is in Lakeland. So we'll be taking you there. And had I thought about it more, had I had my wits about me more, I would have asked them to take me to Tampa General, only because my family, my house is like an hour and a half away from Lakeland. And, you know, it was just a long drive every day for my husband to take. But anyhow, I didn't have
you
my
just weren't thinking. Why weren't you focused on this?
I wasn't thinking. So they took me to Lakeland, and just the paramedics were just fabulous. You know, I can't remember the paramedic's name, but I remember him telling me he had five kids, and I can remember the driver apologizing for every little bump in the road. We had to drive over some railroad tracks, and I can remember her just apologizing profusely, because any movement, Scott, like any movement, just it was painful. It was really, really painful. So they gave me as much pain meds as they could, and they couldn't give me a whole lot until I got to the hospital. So we got to Lakeland Memorial, and you know, some of the good things about being a trauma case or whatever you want to call it is that you get like speedy stuff. Like your medical assessments, your triage, your CAT scans, your x-rays, your blood work, all that stuff is like done in a second. So they wheel me in and they do like a quick assessment and then immediately take me to CAT scan and x-rays, and it, what seems like, and I saw my husband arrived. So, and I was so grateful that my daughter now, who was with me, who refused to drive in the ambulance, who drove and followed my friend Elise in my car to Lakeland. So now my daughter had her dad, you know, my husband. And that was nice. She looked pretty freaked out, and she still doesn't like to talk about it, which is okay. Anyhow, I think she was traumatized that day. I think she knew how close things could have, you know, gone differently. I think had I landed a little bit differently, even just an inch, half an inch different, things would have definitely, if I landed on my chest, things could have, you know, I wouldn't be doing a podcast with you today, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. And that was your concern at the time, is that you didn't want her to be so traumatized.
Yes. Yes.
But even though you minimized that as much as you could, you know, 14-year-old kid, that's not something they should say. I mean, some adults would be traumatized by that.
Yes. But she's as any kid, she's resilient, and she's a fabulous child. So I'm in the initial assessment, and they look at the CAT scan and the x-rays, and you know, the doctor said, look, let's hope for a broken hip and not broken pelvis and stuff. Let's just hope for that. And we're like, okay, we'll hope for that. And by that time they gave me some pretty good drugs. So I was like, that's great. So within probably, it seemed like 20 minutes. It was very quick. Within an hour of me getting to the hospital, I don't know what I expected, but I can remember feeling when they read my x-rays and CAT scan and stuff, and the doctor said, okay, we're going to take you to a room now. I was like, what do you mean you're going to take me to a room? Like it's not what I expected. I expected would be able to just get up and walk away, and it would just be, you know, would just be a little boo-boo and that was it. And so they had, they took me to the trauma floor at Lakeland Memorial, which is always an interesting place, house of horrors. And I say that only because, you know, there's some pretty bad stuff that goes on, bad accidents, car accidents, motorcycle wrecks, people moaning, crying. It was just an interesting time to spend a week on the trauma floor. Is not something that I would recommend for anyone to do for entertainment. But anyhow, they take me to a room, and I'm sharing a room with a woman who got in a motorcycle accident. So they dubbed our room the female daredevil room. And so we get, I get to the room, and they're not sure yet whether I need surgery. And they say, no, you don't need, you know, initially, no, you don't need surgery. And this was a Saturday. And I was like, good. And they said, we'll have someone else read the x-rays, but we think you're good. You just need to just rest for right now. I'm like, okay. So they gave me pain meds, and I was still in a lot of pain, and they would come in and try to move parts of, I still couldn't move. I still could not move the left side of my body at all. And I was still in a lot of pain.
Well, let me ask you this. I want to clarify this. When you say you couldn't move, you weren't paralyzed, but you're saying you couldn't move because it would be too painful.
Yes. Yes. That's okay. Right. I couldn't move because it was so painful. And I don't know how I made it through that first night, because they would come in and they would try, the nursing staff or whoever, I don't know what their titles were, they would try to move me, and I couldn't get out of bed. So I had a bedpan, and they would try to like move up my pelvis to put the bedpan under. I'm like, no, you guys don't understand, but this is really like, I would scream in pain and I would be sweating, and it was pretty bad. It was pretty bad. So the Sunday morning rounds, the trauma doctors come and they go to every patient and ask them questions and do an assessment. And I said, look, every time, if I breathe, if I move just a certain way, there's something that's not right in my, like my lower back. It's just like, it's an electrical shock that I'm feeling. This is not, and it's very, very painful. So they came back in a little bit later and said, okay, you're going to have surgery today. We're going to put your leg in traction, so to allow for the swelling to go down or something. I can't remember exactly what they said. So that was Sunday. I had some skydiving and ultra running friends who came to the hospital, and we were just hanging out, and my surgery was scheduled for 4:00 on Sunday. And I was the only, I can remember getting wheeled down to the surgery center and being the only person in there. And it was just probably one of the loneliest times ever. It was just me. I was just, it was only me. And I was, you know, and you're thinking, what's going to happen? What could go wrong? Am I going to walk again? Will I run again? Will I be able to do the things I've always loved doing? And I had asked the trauma surgeon that before, and he said, I don't know. You know, I can't promise you anything, but you likely won't be able to do all of those things. So the reality of my injury, and by the way, the injury I had was I had broke my pelvis in 4 places, my sacrum, and my L4, L5 transverse process. So it was actually, once they had someone else look at the x-rays and the CAT scans, it was, I think, more than what they initially thought. So I had that surgery on Sunday. They put my leg in traction, which was pretty archaic, because when I got back to my room, I'm kind of looking at it, and you get this steel rod put through your femur right above your kneecap, and then there's like wires that come out of that that attaches a rope to a sandbag at the end of my bed. So, and I kept looking, I'm like, that is really weird. Like, that's really bizarre and very archaic. And I kept, every time someone walked into the room, because I was the first bed, I'd say, please don't hit that sandbag. Like, whatever you do, do not hit that sandbag. And,
because that's a natural human inclination. Oh, there's a sandbag hanging there. I better punch
it.
Oh, right?
Gosh. or accidentally rub up against it when you're getting to the other bed or moving something for me. And so I still couldn't move. And I couldn't move until I had another surgery scheduled on Tuesday. So it was an interesting time. Some of it I don't remember because of the good, great drugs I had from being hospitalized. But I just started wondering, am I going to be able to do all the things I'd love? And I thought, you know what? There's no doubt. There's absolutely no doubt I'll be able to do it. even if the doctors say I can't, I'll definitely overcome this and be able to do it. And then I started wondering, well, you know, what's the goal for recovery? And the doctor said, look, you're going to be in a wheelchair for a while, and then you'll graduate to crutches, a wheelchair to a walker to crutches to one crutch, and then you'll be able to, you know, bear your own body weight. And it's going to take quite a while for you to get that done. You'll likely be in the wheelchair for probably 6 months, and then the walker and crutches for, you know, months, 3 or 4 months after that, and then the single crutch. And so it's going to be a long recovery. So they're telling me this, and I'm like, dude, you don't know me. And I'm looking at my husband, and he's like, we have this communication thing going, this nonverbal communication.
Cause he does know
you. He does know me, and he knows that I'm just not going to settle for that. And that's just not how I roll. So, you know, you just decide, Scott, and it's a mental decision that you're going to get through this. You're going to recover, and you're going to come back no matter what anyone says. You're going to just come back stronger and much more knowledgeable and better than you were before. And you live life differently. You look at things a lot differently. And, you know, I had my second surgery on Tuesday, where they put a 7-inch steel screw in my back. It goes through my pelvis and my sacrum, which it's still there. So 7 inches, if you imagine that, that's pretty big. And I'll have to show you the x-ray of it. I think it's posted on my Instagram account from that time. But anyhow, it's interesting because you can just see how big it is. So I had that inserted and my leg taken out of traction, thank goodness. And the very next day, that Wednesday, they wanted me to get out of bed. And now my husband, we live an hour and a half from Lakeland Memorial Hospital. So he would drop our daughter off at school, run an hour and a half to see me at the hospital, stay for like 2 hours, drive back, pick Jessica up from school, make her dinner, and then come back to the hospital. So it was pretty stressful for him. But on Wednesday, they said, we want you to get out of bed and try to move from the bed to the chair. And it probably took me 45 minutes to just sit my body up and move moving my feet over to the side of the bed. I was sweating like I had just run 50 miles. It was so much work, and it was so hard. So I finally was able to just do that, move, you know, sit up and move my legs over to the side of the bed. And then they said, okay, let's try to move to the chair. So, you know, they help you, or they show you ways in which to do that. And once I got in the chair, I was exhausted. I was so exhausted. And I just thought to myself, holy cow, this is going to be harder than I thought, because it just took me what seems like forever to get from the hospital bed to the chair. And I'm exhausted beyond anything I've ever felt before. And how am I going to get back? Okay. I have to get back into that hospital bed. But anyhow, it's just a funny, I don't know, the little tiny things that you take for granted, brushing your teeth with running water, you know, taking showers, all of those things that you don't get to do when you're, you know, bound in a hospital bed.
Well, it seems like from what I can see on, you know, what you wrote about this and just talking with you, your general attitude throughout the recovery was determined and optimistic.
Yes.
How much of a big part of your recovery was your attitude in going into it?
So it has to be, in my opinion, it has to be at least 90%, because I think, and I know, that your body reacts to how your mind thinks and what you perceive. Your body's going to react to that. So if I thought, my goodness, I'm never going to be able to run again, I'm never going to be able to bike again. I'm never going to be able to climb, do these other things that I love to do. Then I'm not going to be able to do that. But if I say, you know what, I'm going to run these, I'm going to be able to do this. I'm going to be able to run, bike, climb mountains. I'm going to be able to do all of these things. Then I'm going to do it. And you just have to have that mindset. Otherwise you're defeating yourself already. You've set yourself up for failure before you've even started. And that just doesn't make any sense. And it's just a lot of negative energy that goes nowhere.
Now that the jump and this whole thing was 3 years ago. Are you fully recovered now?
So I was supposed to be in the wheelchair for the 6 months and then months of other recovery. And the accident happened in October 2015, and less than, well, a year after, in November 2016, I ran a 100-mile race and finished. And then...
That was at Fort Clinch?
Nope, that one was at Save the Daylight. So Save the Daylight, okay. That was November 4th, 2016, just a month and like 2 weeks after my... pardon me, a year and 2 weeks after my accident, I said, you know what, you're not going to be able to do this. And I did. And then just to make sure that I wasn't dreaming, a month and a half later, I ran another 100-mile race at Skydive Ultra and finished that as well. So I just wanted to make sure I could do it.
I think you kind of proved that point. And, you know, not to overemphasize this point too much, but also since the accident, you did a little bit of mountain climbing, right?
I did. It was trekking, really. And I did a trek to Everest Base Camp.
And we're talking about Mount Everest.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, you just brushed it off. Oh, yeah, I went to Everest Base Camp. But, I mean, that's just getting to base camp. What's the altitude on that?
Base camp is 17,600 feet, but you have to go up a little to come down to base camp. So it was, I think, 18,600 down to 17,600. And I did that for an organization called Radiating Hope, which helps build oncology or radiation centers in third world countries. So it was more for them, but also I got some satisfaction out of that as well, just to, you know, continue to push forward and reach goals.
So there are multiple topics here that I could interview you about, but actually you went to Everest. That trek was with our mutual friend, Karen, and I'm hoping to actually have her on the podcast to talk about that.
Yes. She had a much more interesting trip than I did.
It was very interesting. Yes. I saw as you guys posted it on Facebook, it was quite an adventure. So hopefully we'll get her on here at some point and talk about that. You know, in looking back at this, what could you have done differently to avoid that crash landing? Or would a more experienced skydiver have had the same result? Or could there be something, could you have done something?
You know, accidents happen, but I think it's my own inexperience of jumping. I think a more experienced skydiver would have realized that they didn't have to change their landing pattern, that the trees that I was trying to avoid really weren't going to be a danger to me. And that when I realized I was going to either hit the barn and kill myself or stay alive, when I made that decision, I really made a sharp left turn to avoid the barn. And that's obviously what collapsed the side of my, that left side of my parachute and, you know, just pushed me to the ground. So it's just my inexperience.
Have you ever gone back to that spot where you landed?
No, I haven't. But, you know, I've gone back to the drop zone, my home drop zone, which is Zephyr Hills, and just to get back out there. And I haven't jumped yet. And I made a promise to my family that I would wait until our daughter graduated from high school before I jumped again. Now, she's graduating this year, but, I as much as I love it, I'm not sure I want to do that. I'm just not sure I want to do it again.
You got to have your brain go through that whole thought process, right?
Yes. Yeah. I don't know. It's just a part of my life that I don't know. I sold my equipment and I'm just not ready yet. I don't know if I ever will be, but I'd rather climb mountains and try to do other things.
You mentioned that Lee, who was in the plane, he went out first and he videotaped the first part of your free fall part of that jump. I'm going to have that video on the website for this episode so people can watch that if they want to. And also, I'm going to have a link to the blog post that you did about, you know, outlining everything that happened that day as well. So if people are interested in reading that, they can do that. That'll all be at the website, whatwasthatlike.com.
Excellent.
Sue, I'm glad you made it. I'm glad you are here to tell the story. And I wish you the best in your continuing adventures.
Thanks, Scott. And I'll see you out there helping the homeless soon.
Thanks for listening to this episode. My goal for each show is to introduce you to people and stories that you just won't find on other podcasts. If you want to help support the show, you just need to subscribe, and that way you'll never miss an episode. You can click on any of the subscribe buttons on the website, which is whatwasthatlike.com. You'll see all the links right there at the top where you can subscribe directly to this show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Google Play Music, Spotify, Stitcher Radio, or on whatever app you use to catch your podcasts. And you'll see there are also links to Twitter and Instagram, so you can follow us there, and I hope you do. And if you really want to connect with me and get in on the discussion with other listeners to this show, you can join our private Facebook group. You can find that at whatwasthatlike.com/Facebook. And of course, you can always email me directly at scott@whatwasthatlike.com, or just go to the website and click on contact. I'd love to hear what you think of this episode or a previous episode. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you on the next show where we'll once again ask the question, what was that like?